Hello, and I would like to welcome our listeners to another edition of the Crossroads Podcast. I'm Matt O'Brien, reporter and senior editor for Infralogic's North American coverage. I'll be your host today. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce our guest today, someone who's going to go over the ever-changing landscape of fund managers, their limited partners. We'll even go over some surprise asset targets this year and, you know, some other things that are going on in the infra investing universe. I have with me Managing Director and Global Co-Head Business Development Infrastructure Partner Group's Irene Mavroianis. Irene, welcome. How are you?
Thank you, Matt. Great to be here and to participate in this podcast. And of course, to talk about my favorite subject, infrastructure.
Happy to hear that. Well, I got the right person on then. Thank you for agreeing to talk with me today. And so, like usual, there's a lot going on with infra funds themselves, capital formation, what they're targeting and the like. I'm hoping to get some of your unique perspective on the latest that, you know, we've been tracking here at InfraLogic that, you know, daily readers are more than familiar with, some of the issues and themes that we tackle. Let's just jump in. Now, it seems like the big keep getting bigger, especially in light of recent GP level M&A, I'll call it that. I want you to talk to me about why some GPs over the last few years have shifted their strategy of focusing more on the mega capitalization space.
Sure. Great question. You know, in our view, it's largely attributable to a couple of factors. The first is that infrastructure is a young asset class. It really started taking off in the last 10 to 15 years. In 2000, there were 7 fund managers who raised over $1 billion. In 2022, there were 156 funds that raised $176 billion. So as investors have been appreciating and begun to appreciate the benefits of the asset class, namely the inflation protection, stable returns, exposure to essential assets, they've been allocating more capital to the space. And as allocations to the asset class have grown, a small number of well-known managers, primarily the early entrants into infrastructure, have grown their fund sizes alongside the LPs to take advantage of growing appetite for the strategy. As you correctly noted, you know, the recent M&A activity in the infra space, BlackRock acquiring GIP, General Atlantic, and Actis, have reinforced the shift towards larger fund sizes. Coming back to mega cap, mid cap, there really is no standard definition of mega cap, just like there is no standard definition of what is infrastructure. But from our perspective, you need to look under the hood of the size of the fund at the size of the equity check to give you back of envelope indication of whether it's a mid-market or a mega fund. Equity checks north of about $1 billion in our view would qualify or could easily be considered as a mega fund.
Thank you for that. Yeah, certainly look, the Blackstone GIP news, that story's so far for 24 has received the most clicks on our end. It's definitely captured the attention, not surprisingly, of, you know, funds and LPs and everybody else, advisors, everybody else involved. So something, you know, we're keeping a close eye on for future tie-ups. Let me ask you this. What are your findings on how that has impacted GP performance and how raising such funds is going in this, let's call it, a difficult environment of fundraising?
Another great question. I'd say as a general observation, we've seen an inverse correlation between the size of the fund and the performance of the fund. And this relates to the former mid-market funds that have migrated into the mega space. Some of these have not continued to perform as previously. There could be a number of reasons for that fact, including difficulty in adapting a mid-market strategy and skill set to a dramatically different investing landscape, because the size of the sandbox in which the manager plays affects the breadth of the opportunity set. Mid-market transactions, for example, typically lend themselves to proprietary acquisitions with scale-up opportunities, whereas larger transactions may have a greater focus on corporate carve-outs or take privates given the size of the equity check to be deployed. And there's also a difference in the optionality on exits. You know, mid-markets typically will have more optionality on exits because the size of the ultimate equity check can be absorbed by a strategic, another larger fund or a corporate. But when you're playing at the mega end of the scale, that optionality is somewhat limited, often to, you know, the IPO market, which I think we'll talk about later. On the fundraising aspect, you know, namely whether strategy drift has negatively impacted some of these mega funds' ability to raise capital in this environment, it has, but quite frankly, the difficult environment has probably affected all of the fund managers equally. However, with the growing appetite for the asset class, new investors are continuing to come into the space, and they naturally have sought to deploy capital with the more established GPs. So this has actually reinforced the growth of the largest GPs and migration of fund sizes. Fundraising numbers tend to prove this out. About half of the total capital from 2020 to 2022 was raised by only 15% of the number of funds that were raised, which really means that LPs have portfolios that are concentrated with a small number of larger GPs. So ultimately, in this initial phase, the mega fund managers continue to do relatively well from a capital raising perspective, but this may change over time if they're unable to deliver on returns and as the private infrastructure an asset class continues to grow and mature.
Those are interesting figures you threw out. And like I said, feels like we're in a new world where the big just keep getting bigger. It's incredible. I just want to switch gears slightly here. What assets, you know, are typically not associated with infrastructure yet, you know, display those infra traits could serve as targets by GPs this year? And often, you know, when we look at this issue and we've looked at it over the last few years, we usually use EQT's 2015 acquisition of Wash Multifamily Laundry Systems. Again, that was that company that provides, as the name would suggest, laundry systems for multifamily properties in the US and Canada. I mean, I know there's been others since, but you know, that's usually one we just cite often. So what is 2024's version of Wash?
I won't talk about Wash specifically because I guess the focus I would take is on assets that are displaying infrastructure traits. So I would pivot slightly towards where do we see future demand for infrastructure that is consistent with assets that have infrastructure traits. So I think areas where you're going to see continued, if not greater expansion, obviously decarbonization is one area. And what's interesting is we expect to see more investments in decarbonization, but in energy efficiency, which is not typically appreciated as an infrastructure opportunity in the clean power space, which typically will focus on new sources of energy. So if you think about hydrogen, solar, wind, battery storage. Energy efficiency, historically, it represents about a third of the solution towards achieving the Paris Accord decarbonization objectives. And yet, you'll see most clean power or renewable focused on the traditional wind, battery storage, some electric vehicle charging, which is further off into the future. We, for example, made an investment in a company in the US called Butterfly. It's a leading energy as a service platform. And what it does is it focuses on providing energy efficient solutions to small franchises because these businesses use 10 times more energy than commercial office buildings. If you think about the HVAC, you think about the fridge, the ovens of a McDonald's, a Wendy's, or even of a Dunkin' Donuts, then the implications and the opportunity set for investments in infrastructure in this space, which is very scalable, are pretty exponential. Other areas that you wouldn't typically think of as infrastructure, but that have infrastructure traits are in the, you know, social assets. If you think about healthcare and you think about education, given global structural trends of an aging population, increased urbanization, and constrained public resources, you know, I think we should expect to see more investment in assets that have a social aspect to them, you know, in light of the factors that I just described. So, for example, we invested in radiology clinics in Germany, really a buy and build strategy focused on roll-ups and operational improvements. But these are in assets that have an essential component of healthcare delivery, regulated market, regulated cash flows with built-in inflation protection. So not intuitively assets one would associate with infrastructure, but then again, infrastructure is not defined. It's really more defined by characteristics as opposed to any of the other private markets asset classes.
Interesting. All right. That's a great insight. Thank you for that. You know, talking about service companies like Butterfly Radiology Company that you were citing before, can you talk to me about how executives are adapting infrastructure to shifting consumer needs?
Sure. And again, you know, from our perspective, and in order to be a successful infrastructure investor, it's critical to invest in infrastructure opportunities that are consistent with essential consumer needs, both near and long term, because infrastructure is a long term play. But as the infrastructure supporting consumer needs is typically driven by long term structural trends, for example, you know, the increased need for social infrastructure that I just described, you know, growing urbanization, digitization, new living standards associated with e-commerce and working from home, it's important to take a long-term view on where these needs will go and focus on investment opportunities in related high-growth sectors. For example, we made an investment in a U.S. trailer leasing business called Milestone, second largest lessor of trailers, fifth largest lessor of chassis in the U.S. The underlying thematic, so shifting consumer need, is the tremendous growth in marketplace as e-commerce drives the need for tech-enabled distribution and the importance for increasing efficiency and new living standard logistics to be closer to home, same-day delivery, reverse logistics. So that's really an underlying driver of consumer need. And then the intersection with how is this infrastructure, and that's how managers evolve the asset class. It's an essential product. Mission critical equipment, solutions to customers, has a very high and stable market share, very asset heavy. So these are the conundrums. This is the puzzle that managers are trying to solve. Where is that intersection between long-term consumer need and how does that fit into an evolving world and lifestyle standards?
Gotcha. Interesting. Yeah, one of the things you pointed out, moving services and infra closer to the consumer, I feel like that's been a trend in various industries, something we're definitely keeping a close eye on. I want to mention something about diversification. You know, many funds tout diversification, you know, but can you talk to me about which assets might be a little bit more risky with a recession looming, possibly?
We are very wary on that subject, as we are with others, because especially with infrastructure, expectation of the asset class is to deliver long-term stable returns. And so investments that have high GDP exposure, we see this typically in stretched definitions of infrastructure or in more traditional forms of infrastructure that are associated with elastic demand. So if you think about airports that primarily serve holiday consumers versus business travel and that derive a high component of their revenue from retail services, those types of investments will undergo more challenges in a market that is recessionary. You know, equally so, strategies that require or that rely actually on excessive leverage to support returns, these are other investments that would quite frankly, fall into the same bucket in terms of increased risk against a challenging macroeconomic backdrop. From a Partners Group perspective, we wouldn't invest in these types of assets or take on that type of leverage because we adhere to a checklist of characteristics that for us, if those checklists are not met, the asset is not deemed to be an investable infrastructure asset. And similarly, with a strategy of hands-on value creation, as opposed to relying on financial structuring, engaging in excessive leverage for us is not the most prudent way to generate returns. But those are, I guess, two major buckets that investors should be wary of as in a very wobbly market.
Right. Being highly leveraged is like the kiss of death when a recession hits. Again, another thing we're keeping an eye on. So interesting indeed. What can you share about the type of conversations you guys are having at Partners Group with LPs on targeted strategies that may appeal to LPs, but that do carry risk in deploying capital and exiting?
Sure. Happy to share on that. First of all, to be clear, every and all investment strategy involves risk. Whether the manager is investing at the core end of the spectrum or any other, you know, risk return profile. There is no such thing as a riskless strategy in the private markets or the public markets, unless we're looking at investing in treasuries or T-bills, and even those involve a different set of risks. Our strategy is primarily value creation through platform building, which involves commercialization and development risk. So at Partners Group, we wear both of these risks, and we believe we've created a playbook for successfully executing the strategy while managing the risk. And we do that using several mechanisms. Firstly, we spend success-based CapEx to support organic growth, which goes back to my point on the financial leverage to generate returns or support returns. We build our platforms using equity and really take a modular approach to expansion. As I said, success-based CapEx to finance the expansion rather than adding risk by levering a development project. And secondly, our prudent use of leverage, you know, overall in terms of financing the project is a critical component. We apply leverage when the platform is at a more of an operational stage, which again enables us to generate the most balanced risk return profile in the targeted strategy of platform building that we execute.
Gotcha. And great, thanks. Going back to exits, speaking of exits, you know, I was talking to a banker the other day. He mentioned that we should be on a lookout for IPOs this year, possibly, from infra holdings. Usually, you know, when you talk about that type of exit, it's more associated with venture capital, right? Let me ask you, what can we expect to see here this year or even next?
Conditions were tough for IPO exits last year. I think generally speaking, they were tough for exits, as managers and LPs were grappling with where valuations should or should not be. So IPO exits were off the table for much of the year as investors adopted a risk-off approach. 2024, we should see this start to unwind as we're seeing interest rates begin to stabilize, or should I even dare to say potentially fall, as public market sentiment improves. I think the early part of 24 is going to still present challenges for the market as investors are really treading gently to see where the macroeconomic environment will go, including slower than anticipated economic growth, OPEX inflation, and high interest costs. But we do expect the environment to normalize towards the second half of the year and the spigot for IPO exits to open. And certainly for assets that have a decarbonization thematic, there is a pretty strong market sentiment for those types of assets. So if we think sectorally, what types of assets are most likely to be successful in an IPO exit, it is probably assets within that sector.
Let's go back to limited partners issue. Through your experience, what are LPs looking for when they are searching, when they're searching for fund opportunities to deploy to infrastructure?
They're typically looking for managers that have investment experience, particularly through the economic cycles. In a challenging economic environment, such as the one we're currently living in, the investors are prioritizing long-term stable returns and the ability to weather a downturn. So inevitably turning to managers that have a proven track record, which really brings us back to your very first question, which is why has there been such a stickiness towards these former mid-market, now mega fund managers of capital? It's because they have a longer track record. And that also brings us to your second question, which is how long will that track record continue to perform? We also believe that investors are looking for a differentiated approach to asset selection. From the Partners Group perspective, we have a thematic investing framework, which is unique in that it enables us to stay ahead of the curve in identifying higher growth niche investment opportunities. We also have an entrepreneurial governance model, which supports the execution of our strategies. But I think most importantly, having a long track record in the space and having been able to execute successfully throughout the cycles is what investors will look to when they're deploying their capital.
Thank you. Let me ask you this. There was a lot written about, a lot of discussion around the denominator effect. Is the denominator effect still in effect?
Yes. I mean, the denominator effect is still in effect, but you know, we think there is light at the end of the tunnel and expect gradual improvement in 2024. I mean, as we were discussing before, the asset class infrastructure continues to attract capital on a disproportionate basis compared to some of the other private markets asset classes because of its attractive attributes, and particularly because of its resilient returns in a challenging macroeconomic environment, which is incredibly important given where we have been in the last couple of years. Because it's also a relatively new asset class, we think there's been less pullback than in other private market asset classes as a result of the denominator effect. So our belief is there will be a gradual easing of the denominator effect on a relative and absolute basis, more likely to play out in the second half of the year as investors continue to evaluate and assess now that we're almost done with Q1 and continue that into Q2. So bright light at the end of the tunnel.
All right, noted. Sounds good. I got one last question for you, a little bit separate from everything else. Just real quick, real brief, talk about Partner Group's approach to building value. It's going to be a theme for 24, I've been told. Building value for a platform portfolio company through accretive M&A.
Sure. A major part of our playbook for value creation is platform building. And the reason we do that is we believe that we're able to capture the value differential between building a leading business and buying a fully scaled operating platform. So this typically entails identifying a business with a strong management team, a core of operating assets, and a development pipeline that we can develop, you know, conviction around, and then building those businesses through accretive M&A, but also through organic expansion. It comes back to what I was describing previously, growing the business organically using success-based CapEx, and then making accretive add-on acquisitions at lower multiples to drive the hold multiples down. And that's where we're able to arbitrage the difference between buying a fully scaled operating business and building it. So, for example, we made an acquisition in a hyperscale developer and operator of data centers in the United States a couple of years ago named EdgeCore. It had an advanced commercialization of development pipeline, had $4 billion of total contract value of long-term leases. We grew the portfolio both through efficiently designing the architecture and additional acquisitions so that we could expand its offering. And then ultimately, that means that the favorable entry valuation combined with the campuses that we developed at low double-digit multiples allows new investors to buy down their multiple over time. This is the approach that we've taken consistently. It's a major part of our playbook, and we'll continue to execute on it on a go-forward basis in our platform.
Well, listen, this has been great, insightful, as I was expecting. That's it for now. So I just want to thank our guests, our listeners for tuning in. And please, for those of you listening, don't forget to like and subscribe, Crossroads Podcast, and see you next time.